my instinct would be to, you know, foreigners should stay out of other people's fights. But then sometimes, very, I'm not so closed-minded that I couldn't see that under some circumstances that might be the best solution. And for example, when the British intervened in Sierra Leone in the 1990s under Tony Blair, I think in general that was a successful intervention. It squashed the civil war. It allowed a democratic election, and that was what I would think of as proportionate and sensible intervention. If you think you can really do some good, you know, you've got to ask yourself, am I going to do any good here? Or is it just going to... I mean, if we put a no-fly zone in Libya and Gaddafi just wins by running people over with tanks, which, of course, he might do, even with a no-fly zone in place, are we going to stop him running him over with tanks or only with aircraft? And I think that there's all sorts of games being played here, and I can't see everything that's happening. I mean, obviously, I sit on the internet and try and keep up. But there's so much going on, it's very hard to know exactly what's going on.
Indeed, it's a very worrying situation with the whole no-fly zone thing as well.
Well, it is. I mean, I've got an open mind. I mean, my general philosophy would be, if people in a particular community want something and they are asking for it, then maybe I will consider it. But at the same time, there's a lot of resistance to it by people. I mean, Richard Falk, for example, who's the UN rapporteur on human rights in Palestine, he said, look, we've got to get over this idea that we can intervene militarily and solve other people's problems for them. Because perhaps we can't. I mean, even if we mean well, war is a very blunt instrument. Very blunt instrument. No doubt civilians will be killed. I mean, in Afghanistan, which we've mentioned places where people have forgotten about, there's all sorts of murder and mayhem going on in Afghanistan. Karzai's brother has been killed by US Special Forces, and he's complaining about that. And Karzai, there was some children who were collecting firewood, nine children collecting firewood, were killed by a bomb. And Karzai has come out and said, I want NATO operations in Afghanistan to stop. Just go back to your bases and stay there. Now, there's so much going on. I mean, this is before we start talking about places like Sri Lanka, which have really dropped out of people's consciousness.
But would you mind say, though, I mean, you talk about people, civilians being killed, but wouldn't you say that's one of the facts of war? I mean, collateral damage.
Well, I am not a pacifist, but what people have got to realise, I mean, Oxfam pointed this out years ago, in the 20th century, 85% plus of the casualties are civilians in virtually every war you can think of, whether it's a sort of guerrilla war like in Ireland or a big war like Japan versus the US. Most of the people who die are civilians, and that's modern warfare. And that's why war has got to be the absolutely last resort.
But I mean,
we don't want to be rushing hither and yon, starting wars. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, we were talking about Libya at the moment. I mean, yesterday I was watching on a couple of the news channels that the rebels are not able to hold back Gaddafi's forces, and
they haven't got enough heavy weapons.
But do you think? I mean, because they're calling for a no-fly zone. Now the
that seems to be the call. I mean, there's some confusion about that. But, and of course, this is a self-appointed committee. Who are they? I don't know. Do you know? I mean,
no.
I have no idea who they are.
No, but I mean, no-fly zone though. The support, the one that NATO is backing, Europe and US, but the only two countries that are really, to be honest with you, fighting for the no-fly zone in Europe are Britain and France and the European Union.
The European Union is lukewarm. The Germans, I don't think, are very keen at all. I mean, their instinct is just to stay out of it. France and Britain, of course, have got an imperial history, and they just... I mean, I'm amazed by David Cameron. Even if he wanted to do this, he's not prepared British public opinion, really.
No.
I mean, they did an opinion poll in the United States which said, do you want to intervene in Libya? And 90% of people said no. I mean, you know, they're sorry for the people. I mean, don't forget there are lots of other people being repressed around the world at the moment. In Bahrain, for example, or the Congo. I mean, we forget about this. People are dying every day all over the place, but we can't go charging around intervening in everything, can we?
It's
just infeasible.
Well, I mean, you talk about Bahrain. I mean, just today it's been reported that Saudi has sent troops to Bahrain.
I think that's very significant. That's very significant.
It is.
The Bahraini opposition has said, right, well, that's it then. This is going to be a fight to the finish, and the Saudi maneuver has freaked out the markets. I mean, what everybody's really worried about is disruption of oil supply from Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
And every little quake, you saw that after Friday prayers in Saudi Arabia, there was very, very little, well, hardly any protest, because there was lockdown. You know, the police were everywhere, the army were everywhere, and people were too scared to go out and demonstrate. And you could say, well, that means that Saudi Arabia's at peace and Libya's at war. What it means is in Saudi Arabia, people are so terrified, they don't even dare to go in the street. That's what that means.
Well, that's not a good situation at all.
No, of course it's not. It's been a mess for years. I mean, Yemen, in the south of Saudi Arabia, is where most of the population in Arabia live. And the imperial powers deliberately created Yemen as a separate bit from Saudi Arabia, so that all the oil would be in the hands of a small number of people that they could deal with, the Al Saud family. And it was the Al Saud family were basically put in power by outside forces because they wanted to deal with a few rich people, and they didn't want to share the oil with everybody that lived in the region. And that's been the problem all along. And if the West does intervene in Libya, it won't be to help. The real motivation won't be to help the ordinary people. They want to get the oil, one way or another.
Well,
they'll
deal
with Gaddafi, or they'll deal with somebody else.
Wouldn't it be said the same about Saudi? I mean, if we're hell-bent on intervening Libya, what about all the protests that have been locked down in Saudi and now they sent, which is, as you say, significant development?
It's critical, isn't it? I mean, the Arab League have called for a no-fly zone.
Yes.
Who are the Arab League? Well, the Arab League is King Fahd of Saudi Arabia and the King of Bahrain. And they say, yes, we want you to put a no-fly zone on Libya. What the Americans have said to the Bahrainis, the royal family, is if you promise to reform, you know, say something, we will back you.
Mm.
Well, and that's absurd. I mean, the Bahrain is a civilised, sophisticated society. They're not, as is Libya, they're relatively wealthy societies compared to Egypt. And they could be quite modern countries if the people were allowed to run them. And I can't, you know, but we know that the Americans and the Israelis aren't interested in democracy in the Middle East. They never have been, only if it goes their way.
Well, anyway, I mean, there's been an article on, I think, on a Saturday, that how the Americans actually admitted to unashamedly paying for these uprisings in the Middle East, Egypt
I think,
and Libya.
I mean, this is all very, very speculative, but I think that the there's an element within the American ruling class that thinks that this will be a good idea to encourage, that there's going to be change anyway. Would be their logic. This is sort of Zbigniew Brzezinski and people like that. They'd say there's going to be change anyway, so let's get on the right side of history and let's be, you know, we will provide funds for the people who are trying to change. You know, we'll give them training, we'll give them backing, we'll give them internet access and so on. And that's definitely going on. But that doesn't mean that the ordinary people don't want liberty, because they do. And, you know, inevitably you're going to accept help from anybody who offers it. But I think this whole strategy of trying to manage change in the Middle East is frustrated by one big fly in the ointment, and that is Israel. Israel wants no change. And their policy was to back Mubarak to the hilt, to back Gaddafi to the hilt. And how many people in this country realise that the Israelis are supplying mercenaries to Gaddafi? But that's what's going on. That's what's happening. And they don't want any change. So they're out of line with the British and the French and the Americans. I mean, basically, everybody's... What happens in a crisis like this, like in the run-up to the First World War, suddenly everybody realises who their real friends are. It's like a kaleidoscope shaking, and a whole new set of alliances begins to develop. But the Israelis are really making... You know, they're not making this any easier. They're awkward neighbours to have.
We actually run out of time. We're very close to the break now, but we thank you very much for joining us again and keeping us enlightened and keeping us informed as always.
It's a great pleasure to. I enjoyed coming to visit you last week, and it's a great pleasure to be in dialogue with everybody.
Well, the pleasure was all ours. Martin Summers, thank you very much, and do tune in to Martin's show with Tony Gosling every Friday, 5 till 7 p.m. on Bristol City Community FM.
Or Community Radio. Or you can get it off the internet at thisweek.org.
That's right, thisweek.org.uk. Thank you very much, Martin.
Thank you.
Well, we're also very short on time now as well, so if there's anything you heard that you want to comment on, the number is 0121 772 8892. That's 0121 772 8892. And please do call in and share your views. We'll be glad to listen. Well, you can also go on our Facebook page. That's Facebook Behind the Headlines. Go and find that. Put your comments on there. And we've got an email address as well, Saeed.
That's behind the headlines, 935@hotmail.co.uk.
Back after this.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on 93.5 Community FM.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on 93.5 Community FM.
A catastrophic tsunami rising out of the Pacific. Its huge waves sweeping away everything in its path. A massive wall of water that rose as high as 30 feet in other parts of Japan.
Shaken violently, part of the ceiling of the terminal building fell.
This is from our camera reporter in Miyagi. And it looks like the tsunami has engulfed several cities in Miyagi Prefecture.
At the Sendai Airport, it took only 30 seconds for water to overtake the runways. Soon after, the 16-foot airport tunnel overflowed, filling with cars.
...93.5 Unity FM Birmingham, the Heart City and the surrounding areas. It's just after 9 o'clock today, the 15th of March. You are listening to Behind the Headlines with myself, Syed Ahmed, and Tariq Ziad. You just heard there some video audio footages, audio clips more, shall I say, about the tragic event that took place in Japan on Friday. Many of us have seen it on our televisions. And no words can actually describe what they're actually going through. It's a disaster. It's absolute horrifying for anybody to have to put up with it. Many people have lost their lives. Many, many more still missing. Communities have been washed away. And as we were saying at the top of the first hour, you know, at this moment in time, Japan in need of, you know, us to actually, you know, stand by them, whatever we can, spiritually, physically. Our thoughts and our prayers are with the people of Japan at the moment, and may this tragedy make the times become easier for them. Tariq, you must have seen those footages. It just brings it all home, doesn't it? The strength of Mother Nature.
Well, I wouldn't put it as a strength of Mother Nature. I'd say it's obviously it's God's doing, and
Absolutely.
Obviously it's in His infinite wisdom. That's what I believe, of course, and I'd stand by that as well. And
me too. Yeah.
Although we may not understand it, then obviously we have to do the right thing, you know, regardless of, you know, what our faith or creed may be. And of course, the right thing is to assist these people. That's a key thing.
Absolutely.
Not to speculate over the why, where. It's pointless really talking about, you know, the whole scientific aspect of it. I think the real thing is that the devastation here, there's the implications of it, and we need to make sure that help gets to these people. And we also need to wake up and realize that the wider issue for me is that, you know, there was nuclear plants here. Nuclear plants exploded today as well. And this has been a common thread on Behind the Headlines, throughout shows, throughout our previous shows like You Classified as well. Is nuclear energy, is it any good, or is it just a no-go?
Well, I think, Tariq, talking of nuclear, and we're going to be joining our guest from Bristol Community FM very, very shortly, Tony Gosling. But just one point, quick point. I mean, the nuclear energy, it does have its pros and cons, and the disadvantage is, many may say that nuclear fuel is cheap. Yes, it is cheap, or it can be cheap, so they tell us. But the disadvantage is what we're seeing at the moment that's happening in Japan. To talk to us a little bit more about that and many other topics, joining us from BCFM is Mr. Gosling. Tony, good evening.
Good evening. Thanks for having me on again.
Fine. Well, thanks for coming on, and it was good to see you last week doing the show live with us here at Unity FM.
I think the word Fukushima is a word that we're going to be hearing again and again into the future. Because
I believe
This is looking like one of the biggest accidents up there alongside Three Mile Island and Chernobyl. When this all first, I mean, I'm 48 years old. I can remember when I was a child. There used to be a series on the television called Thunderbird. And in that series, it was just a sort of cartoon program. I'm sure many people have seen it. They would have this kind of spooky music, and then they'd say, you know, announce something. Well, I'm sure one of the programs was about a nuclear power plant. They'd say, a great trumpet would announce, we finally built an earthquake-proof nuclear power station. And these were the famous last words, weren't they? Because that's actually what the Japanese authorities were trumpeting, that this was earthquake and tsunami-proof, this nuclear power station, that the safety procedures that were in place there meant that it was able to cope with the worst possible type of incident that might take place. So what we've seen over the last, 5 days or so, is slowly unfolding. All of those turn to dust. So really what's happened is that the authorities have been, I think, really overplaying how safe these reactors are. Now, they do this because many of the people who are actually making the decisions about whether to spend the money on these reactors aren't really au fait with the safety risks and the technology itself. One thing we always must remember, and it's very interesting the way that the Japanese authorities and the Prime Minister himself are actually referring back to the Second World War, where the first ever, and the only so far, thank God, nuclear weapons have been used in anger at Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan. So the most important thing, I think, to understand about this nuclear power is, first of all, is that it is not cheap. It is extremely expensive to actually create and construct a nuclear power station. Very, very expensive. Much more expensive than almost any other type of power generation, in fact. Because of all of the safety that's needed in the chain that brings the uranium to enrichment and then to the power plant and then disposes of the uranium or stores the uranium. And ultimately, nuclear power, whether it's in Japan, whether it's in India, whether it's in China, whether it's in France, or whether it's in the USA, or whether it's in Britain, is ultimately a technology derived from the weapons industry. And the product of this nuclear power is the spent fuel rods. These are then reprocessed afterwards. They call it reprocessing. Essentially, when the fuel rods, when they're spent, are incredibly radioactive. What they do is they put them through these various chemical processes and they extract from them plutonium, because it's actually only from these nuclear reactions that you can obtain plutonium, which is then used in nuclear weapons. So this, what is being put forward as an industry which is going to be great for the future, and it's going to be, zero carbon power generation, they call it, and isn't it wonderful that it's a zero carbon industry? Actually, there's a tremendous number of dangers involved in it, and we've seen all those dangers, really the worst nightmares, come to pass in Fukushima over the last few days. And in fact, there is another power station which is having all sorts of problems too. We've had the third explosion on one of the reactors this morning, and there is all sorts of doubts over whether the primary containment, it's about a 2 foot thick steel pressure vessel that goes around the nuclear material in order to make sure that none of it leaks out. It seems quite likely that under the incredible pressure built up by the heat inside these reactors, because when they're not being cooled, what happens is the nuclear fuel rods just get hotter and hotter and hotter until they melt. Basically, it becomes molten uranium. And when they're in that state, they're not separated. They run together as a liquid, and the whole thing gets hotter and hotter. And it's very easy, once that's happened, for the pressure to build up in this steel vessel. And it actually acts almost like a balloon. So it blows up, and it blows up to a certain degree, and then it goes bang, basically, and it pops out loads of radiation. It does look as if that may well have been what's happened here. Let's not forget that there's been a cordon around the site, which has stopped any real scrutiny of what's going on there. We've also heard that, this happened particularly at Chernobyl, and also at Three Mile Island, where actually some of the personnel working on the site are very brave and go in and actually expose themselves to sometimes lethal doses of radiation in order to try and make the reactor safe.
Well,
we know that things are getting a bit desperate because they've announced today that they're talking about pouring seawater from helicopters into the reactor pressure vessel from above.
Well, what would that do?
That is actually one of the last resorts to try and stop what's called a meltdown, and that's when the fuel rods in the reactor get so hot that they actually become liquid, and they melt their way through, they actually burn their way through the steel in the pressure vessel, and they start to descend down into the rock underneath the reactor. Now, when this kind of thing happens, which is what happened at Three Mile Island, for example, in the US, now, this is a very dangerous situation because you end up with a kind of molten ball of radioactive uranium just burning its way through the rock underneath the reactor. And this, of course, can cause a massive release of radiation because it's so hot, there's an updraft from the molten uranium. And what happens essentially is that radiation is belching out of the top of the reactor. Now, it's not like the sort of explosion, it's not like a nuclear bomb going off or anything like that, but the explosion actually pushes this radioactive dust and dirt and grime out into the atmosphere. And, of course, it's very, very dangerous for all people around it. I mean, my own personal view is that, first of all, it was absolutely insane for the Japanese to build the reactor on the side of Japan, where the fault line is. This is a crazy thing to do. If the Japanese decide that they are going to have nuclear reactors, then, for goodness sake, build them on a site around Japan which is going to be away from the most dangerous earthquake zone.
I mean, do you think, Tony...
on the opposite, on the northern and western... fringe of the island of Japan.
I mean, we've seen the Fukushima explosions. I mean, do you think if the nuclear, the radiation isn't contained, do you think this could be one of the nuclear, quite severe nuclear incident in peacetime, in times of peace?
Well, it certainly is. I mean, it's already been shown that it is actually, it looks like this is going to be quite a serious disaster. I mean, you know, the fact that we've had three of... I mean, what happens basically is you've got your fuel rods in the middle, your uranium fuel rods. They're getting hot, very, very hot because the cooling water, the water has stopped pumping through that cools them. I mean, that water is normally turned very quickly in the reactor into steam. So you can imagine if there's no water going in, the fuel rods are getting very hot, very, very fast. The tremendous amount of energy in there. And you've got the pressure, what's called the steel pressure vessel, which is this nearly two foot thick steel, should we say, sphere around it. Now, outside, that's called the primary containment. Outside of that is what's called the secondary containment, which is the concrete building around it. So the idea is that if anything happens to that pressure vessel, say, for example, there's a serious leak from it, they don't really think of these things exploding. But it might be that a crack appears in it, for example, and some of the radioactive material leaks out. The idea is that the secondary containment, that's the concrete block square building you may have seen on the TV around it, will then contain the radiation. Now, what's happened at two of these out of the four reactors at Fukushima is that those secondary containments have actually blown to pieces. So it's in a very, very fragile situation over there. And I'm absolutely certain that there's quite a careful eye being kept on what information is being released to the public about what's going on there.
Well, I mean,
it does cause alarm to the people who are living immediately around it and downwind of it. And let's not forget, some of the biggest problems with the Chernobyl incident were in Western Europe and here in Britain and in Wales, for example. What happens is when there's a disaster like this, you get a plume of I'm not saying this is absolutely definitely going to happen in Japan, but what is quite common is you get a plume of radiation which actually goes for hundreds and hundreds of miles, and even thousands of miles through the upper atmosphere.
Mm.
What I'm saying is with this one in Japan, with the prevailing winds as they are, it may be that the fallout from this disaster actually lands in the United States.
Well, I mean, do you think that because the seriousness, and I mean, I was watching the media reports just before I came into the studio here, and they actually evacuated over 140,000 people around the area of that nuclear reactor. It was yesterday, as you said yourself, that it could actually have effects, it could affect the United States. Do you think that, I mean, because of the prevailing wind and the with the ocean, do you think that we could actually see a bit of that radiation contamination here in Europe?
Well, I don't think it's not likely to be really dangerous levels here, but certainly when something like this happens, actually, a bit of radiation is spread right around the world. I mean, you know, a little bit of going into the upper atmosphere, and these clouds, of course, if it's contained in water droplets and in, you know, tiny portions of air, it will actually circulate right around the world. It's not the sort of thing that you're going to probably be able to detect anywhere but in the immediate plume downwind of what's going on. But you know, we keep hearing, well, this kind of thing, don't worry about it here in Britain. It doesn't really affect us because, of course, we don't get earthquakes here in Britain. Now, funnily enough, I happen to know that I don't know if it was last night, tonight, or tomorrow, but I know the BBC 2 programme Newsnight is actually looking at some of the big waves and earthquakes. I mean, for example, here in Bristol, we had a freak storm which blew, this is about 150 years ago, a fantastic amount of water down the Severn Estuary, up the Avon Gorge, and into the city here, and flooded the city. Now, this is the sort of thing that could quite easily happen.
Well, I mean, Tony, we have had, you know, we have had earthquakes in Britain. I mean, 1990 was one of them. I mean, okay, they were nothing compared to what they've got in Japan at the moment.
I think the thing is that this earthquake and the tsunami, particularly the tsunami, was incredibly devastating, and the Japanese simply were not prepared for it. The safety measures that are involved, I mean, basically what happens is with these reactors, is you have a whole bunch of cobalt rods that go in between the fuel rods in the reactor. And what should happen is if anything goes wrong, those cobalt rods should drop into the reactor and actually slow down the reaction process, and the reactor should then just naturally begin to cool down. It seems pretty clear to me that that hasn't happened in this process, so something has gone drastically wrong with at least three of these four reactors. So they've got a basic disastrous design fault, and I, you know, for me, there is actually no real justification for using nuclear energy in an economic sense, in a moral sense, because what you're doing is you're handing the legacy of this highly radioactive fuel onto literally 500,000 years into the future. It continues to be radioactive. So you're saying to future generations, you know, and generations, that you're going to have to deal with this. We had a bit of power when we were around, but even in hundreds of thousands of years' time, people are still going to be having to store that waste, look after that dangerous waste. I think that actually there's a very good moral case now for saying we don't want any more nuclear power. Let's just close down all these nuclear power stations and go back to using older style, safer types of power generation, and also to actually reduce our power consumption and to start thinking about, well, maybe we shouldn't just simply satisfy all the demand there ever is going to be for energy. Let's look at the way we use fossil fuels. For example, if you have a train going across the country, it uses far less fuel than a whole load of cars going across the country. So let's start thinking about the way we use it. What's happened is with the whole energy industry is we have been suckered in to using far more energy, and now, of course, the price is going up and going up and going up. So
well,
we're
going
to have to think about how much we use in the future.
Well, I mean, despite, you know, what's been going on in Japan, I mean, events in the Middle East are escalating day by day. Today, it's been reported that Saudi has sent troops to Bahrain to suppress the protesters there.
Just before we get on to that, one thing more I want to say about the threat, because one thing I've not heard on any of them, this is one of those behind-the-headlines moments, if you want, is that people have been saying, oh, well, this couldn't happen in Britain and this kind of thing. Well, actually, I hate to tell you, but our terrorist threat level in Britain is only one away from critical. And this is according to the Joint Terrorism Analysis Centre, which is a branch of the security service MI5. They're telling us that the threat level for a terrorist attack in Britain is severe, which means highly likely. So, no, it doesn't look like we're going to have any problems with our nuclear reactors with regards tsunamis here in Britain. But there is the spectre of terrorist attack, which may well... it's not just me saying this. This is MI5 saying that the terrorist threat level here in Britain is severe. So So we may face a similar sort of thing. Mm. Now, any terrorist looking at what's happening in Japan is going to think, oh, what a great place to put my bomb, aren't they?
Well, absolutely. I mean, they must watch it. They say they are watching this. I'm thinking, you know, how efficient the attack would be if they were to attack one of the two or three power stations we got here in Britain.
So there you go. There's a very good reason to withdraw from these foreign conflicts, to bring our troops out of Afghanistan and stop the mercenaries in Iraq and various other places. And certainly we should be thinking to ourselves, let's not start intervening in all these other countries. But isn't it interesting? No, just moving on to what you were talking about, Bahrain. Isn't it interesting, the double standards? When you look at Bahrain and Libya, these are incredible contrast to the Foreign Office and the British government's attitude. And this is where we could maybe mention another behind-the-headlines moment, where many of the experts, or I would say so-called experts, that have been being reeled out since Friday to talk about the nuclear disaster particularly, have been from an organisation called Chatham House. Now, Chatham House, many people will think, well, it's obviously just some kind of think tank. Actually, it is a privatised version of the official Foreign Office. It is a private organisation, basically a private club, which makes up policy. So we're seeing these people being put onto all sorts of TV programmes, and I can remember being asked by producers to put Chatham House on when I was working in London, in the newsroom in London for Greater London Radio. They'd say, oh, get someone from Chatham House on. Actually, since then, I've realised that Chatham House is by no means an unbiased organisation. It's basically a private club which has its own ideas about the way things should go. And one of the things I could tell you is that they are very pro-nuclear power. So when one of those so-called experts comes on to tell you about what's been going on in Fukushima, they are actually giving you biased information. In fact, on Radio 5 Live yesterday morning, they even had a chap who was supposed to be an editor for a BBC a science website. And he was, again, incredibly pro-nuclear. What I want to hear is I want to hear both sides of the argument. I want to hear nuclear engineers who've worked on these stations explaining how they work and explaining what may happen. But I also want to hear people who have been... we have campaigners like the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. We've got every nuclear power station in Britain has got a campaign group locally which is campaigning against it. And this is exactly the sort of thing that they've been warning of. So let their voices be heard. And I find absolutely disgusting that there's not enough attention been paid in the press generally to nuclear safety, because what the government is now trying to do, and Chris Huhne, who is the Energy Secretary, is to actually roll out a whole new tranche of nuclear power stations here in Britain. And I think that the timing of this earthquake and tsunami in Japan and this nuclear disaster is a real wake-up call for us here in Britain. And what we should be doing is thinking to ourselves, well, hang on a minute, maybe nuclear is not really the best way to go. And even if it's this disaster has been going on for just a few days in Japan, but I can guarantee it's going to be a very, very long time, probably decades, before the mess that's being created now with this nuclear material flying around, possibly burning its way into the ground, certainly loads of radiation being scattered around that area, with the Americans being able to pick it up 100 kilometres away. It's a wake-up call to tell us that we really should not be doing this. And I think, you know, we really need to learn lessons right around the world and say, hang on a minute, this is not safe. This stuff is not safe. Let's just rein back the amount of energy we use, and then we don't need any more nuclear. Thank you very much.
But have we though, Tony, learned any lessons? I mean, Chernobyl 1986, now Fukushima 2011. I mean, have we taken any lesson, if we, actually give us that wake-up call? I mean, this is more recent, but even Chernobyl, I mean, it still goes on, the radiation there. And this Fukushima is bound to go on for, you know, quite a long time now.
Well, it's frustrating because, you know, as I was talking about Chatham House, much of the coverage of this event over in Japan has been, certainly the initial coverage has been done by these Chatham House people. And they are actually quietly pro-nuclear. So we're getting a lot of spin in the news. There's one nuclear engineer called John Large, who, he's the guy that the Fire Brigades Union here in Britain go along to and he will do reports for them, so that they, and they actually trust him, that he really is an independent nuclear consultant, and he knows exactly how these things work, because he helped design the Magnox power stations back in the 1960s.
Hey, Tony, is the boss man in?
Wally, you know the boss don't like getting disturbed when Unity FM 93.5's on.
Is that on www.unityfm.net?
The very same. Now clear off, Wally, and come back later.
Come on, boy, just get out of here.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on 93.5 Unity FM.
What we'll do, as we're obviously we're waiting for Tony, is earlier on I played a little bit of a video, actually, which was from the website positivemoney.org.uk, where we played a clip of Ben Dyson talking about banking, the banking system as well. And here's another little clip as well, just to keep us going. And this is called The Consequences of Fractional Reserve Banking. It's a very interesting piece, so do have a listen to this.
The first consequence of fractional reserve banking is that banks have a monopoly on the supply of money to the economy. So these few companies in the City of London have an absolute monopoly on supplying money to the whole of the rest of the UK economy. And the same situation applies around the world. Banks in the US have a monopoly on supplying money to the public and to businesses in the US, and in every other country it's pretty much the same. So you have the banks and the public, and the banks supply money to the public by making loans. Now, there is no way that the public can get any money unless the banks make loans. The public then has to repay the loans plus the interest back to the banks. The thing is, if the banks don't lend, then there is no money. We're absolutely entirely dependent on bank lending for there to be a money supply in the economy, because that's the only way that the numbers in your bank account that you use to trade with other people to buy things actually are created. So banks have this complete monopoly on the supply of money to the economy. So in the aftermath of the crisis, you probably heard a lot of people saying, you know, we're addicted to debt, we've been living beyond our means, we need to reduce our debt. You've seen in earlier videos that if we were actually to reduce our debt, then the money supply would start shrinking and we'd throw ourselves into a recession. But the whole idea that we're addicted to debt is flawed, because you would never say that we were addicted to oxygen. You need oxygen to live. And if some cartel of companies have a monopoly on the supply of oxygen to the economy, then we're going to have to get it from them somehow. And in the same way, we need money for the economy to function. And at the moment, the banks have this monopoly on the supply of money. They create money when we go into debt. And if we don't go into debt, then no money is created. They have an absolute monopoly on the supply of money to the economy. And we're going to see what the implications of that are in the next video.
Well, indeed, that was a very short clip from the website positivemoney.org.uk with Ben Dyson talking to about the system of fractional reserve banking and its many perils in actual fact as well. Thankfully, we do have Tony back with us. Hello, Tony.
Hi, guys. Yeah, interesting, very interesting bunch. I think, you know, for me, for many years, it's been pretty clear that there are two major scams being perpetrated on people all across the world, but, you know, this specifically here in Britain. One is the land fraud, and the other is the money fraud. You know, we've got about 60 million acres of land here in Britain, and we've got about 60 million people, so we've got plenty of land to go around. You know, ultimately, why should anybody be paying anybody else for a bit place to live, when actually my flat that I'm sitting in now takes up only a tiny proportion of that my 1 acre. There's plenty of land to go around. It's just that there are people who basically have managed to get hold of it over the years and are extorting rent from other people. You know, you try and build yourself somewhere to live in this country, it's almost impossible. It's only these big monopoly house builders that actually can get to build houses. So one of our basic fundamental needs, which is talked about in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by the United Nations after the Second World War, is land, is somewhere to live. A home, basically. Everybody needs it, and yet there are many people have to then pay money to somebody else to have their own home, which is scam number one. Scam number two is what Ben was talking about, which is the monopolistic control of the issuance of money. Most people think that the government has some role in issuing money. Actually, they don't. I mean, they do this quantitative easing. But the only way that money can be put into the economy the way it stands is by it being created out of nowhere by these private banks and then spent into the economy as a loan with interest to be paid back. And the fact that the banks are not, you know, really putting the brakes on the lending is one of the reasons why the government is able to then justify cuts. The other thing, well, they try to. So what really, the government is a bunch of cowards. The Treasury are cowards. They need to stand up to the banks and say, hey, guys, who's in charge here? Is it me or is it you? And Harold Wilson, the Prime Minister back in the 1970s, actually did this with the City of London. He said, look, if you think that you're in charge of this country and its money to the city and not me and the government and my Chancellor, then we'll have a general election based on the idea of who is actually controlling the money in this country. And actually what happened was the city and the banks actually backed down because they are private scamsters and monopolists. So really what we really could do with is a bit of a stronger Treasury who are actually able to say, well, hang on a minute, we're going to take control of the situation now rather than just leave it to these vultures in the city.
Now,
and
Tony,
we're going to make sure there's enough money to go around.
We're having a bit of debate here at Unity FM, actually, about the three political parties here. Because I personally feel, as Alan Hart said a few weeks ago on our show, that we shouldn't just blame the bankers, because at the end of the day, if someone will take an inch if the opportunity is there. Really, don't you think we have an impotent government who lets these people get away with the crimes they're committing? And is there any real difference? Is there any of the three major political parties right now that are really looking like they're actually going to stand up to the banks and to the huge corporate mega businesses?
Well, let's be frank. We don't have a democracy in Britain. We have what you might call a broken democracy, where various important links in the chain of getting from what people want through that system of having elections, through the party system, up to the actual individuals that are running the country, that is to say, at least, you know, nominally anyway, the Prime Minister, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, the Foreign Secretary, and these people. There are some very, very bad links in that chain. And people like David Cameron, I think it's fair to say, in no way represents the people of Britain. When he's at international trade conferences, you know, this is somebody who is a member of an elite Oxford secret society, the Bullingdon Club. In fact, it becomes clear now that one of the biggest, strongest voices for the privatisation of the National Health Service in the Cabinet has been Michael Gove, who is also a member of the Bullingdon Club at Oxford with George Osborne and David Cameron, and Ed Vasey as well. So this is basically an elite club that has taken over Britain. I mean, this happens, I think, because of the very weak democratic structures within the three main political parties. So I'm afraid that whoever you vote in, the elite still seem to be in power. And, you know, so there's a big, big democratic deficit. And, of course, the result of this is people are very disillusioned. They don't want to vote. They don't think that it's worth that actually Parliament really represents them and certainly not the government. So I think, you know, the only thing that we can do in this kind of situation is lobby from outside for common sense and make the people who are running our country expose them, really, for being agents of the City of London. Now, if you go back to 1,000 years here in Britain, interest was illegal. Now, very many people, many people don't realise that actually here in Britain it used to be illegal to charge interest, but it was the Norman invasion in 1066 and the Normans that got rid of those laws. So fundamentally, this is a biblical law, the law of usury, which says that you should never charge any interest. That doesn't mean to say that you can't lend money. It's very much, it's identical to the Islamic banks and the Islamic banking system that used to take place here in Britain. And what it basically means is that if you lend somebody money, you can charge a one-off fee for that loan. But you can't do this dreadful thing, which is what's happening to Britain at the moment with the City of London and the government, which is compound interest. So if you haven't paid enough back, it's a bit like your credit card bill getting bigger and bigger every month. If you can't pay, actually, you can get into a situation where you're never going to be able to pay because the interest is getting more and more and more every month. And it's what's called debt saturation on a national scale, where the debt is so big that actually nothing you do is ever going to be able to pay it off. And that's the situation it looks like we're heading into now.
And what about, Tony, the government? You know, for decades now, the way they're privatising all our businesses, you know, the rail. Now we're looking at the NHS possibly as well. I mean, that's a real, you know, that's a, of course, a great concern, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting today, isn't it, that the British Medical Association, basically the doctors' trade, one of the main doctors' trade unions in Britain, is saying that this privatisation of the National Health Service, they want the government to stop trying to pass this bill, and I think they're calling it something like the Health Care Bill or something, which is, if you look at what this is doing, it's actually destroying health care. So we're living in this kind of upside down world where when basic services to ordinary people are being destroyed, they're called something like the Health Care Bill. The reason this is happening is because it's all about power. What it's doing is it's taking the power away from ordinary people and putting it into the hands of a tiny oligarchic elite, that is to say, people who just want to rule without any kind of vestige of democracy. The trouble is, what we've done is we've let them get away with this for far too long, where they have basically agents of big money have infiltrated our political parties and got into some of the key positions.
We're going to take a little break there, Tony. We're just going to take a caller. Hello, caller.
Assalamu alaikum, guys.
Walaikum assalam.
Just like to make a point on the Japan earthquake
situation.
It's a terrible event. And I was reading online that there's this new technology made in America called HARP engineering. And basically, I've read that. And it's like, they're trying to say that you can make it rain, make earthquakes, things like that. I want to ask Tony whether, what he's heard about this, and is it true or is it not?
Well, it is certainly taken seriously by the Russian military that this is a potential technology that may be deployed. Basically, what you're talking about here, I think, is a kind of an earthquake bomb, where you could actually make an earthquake happen. But I don't think that's the case in this instance. I mean, if you look at what's happened historically around the fault lines of the Pacific, you'll see that this is actually quite a predictable incident. I don't know if any of you guys have ever been in an earthquake zone, but I was lucky enough to, about 25 years ago, I spent a week or so in Valparaiso in Chile, which is a very hot spot for earthquakes. In fact, they've had some of the worst earthquakes in human history have happened down in Valparaiso. And this is one of the technologies which I'm really disturbed hasn't actually, it doesn't seem anyway, been employed over in Japan, which is basically what you do is you have to, in a zone like that where there's a lot of people and an earthquake would be particularly devastating, you're constantly monitoring using seismographs the shaking of the earth. And this is no kidding, right? When I was in Valparaiso city in Chile shakes all the time, because it's right on a fault line. And if you put an egg on a table in Valparaiso, half an hour later you come back and that egg has moved. It actually, the whole city is just gently, gently shaking the whole time. And what they do in Valparaiso, and I don't know why they don't do this in Japan, is that they have all these detecting this. And as soon as that shaking stops, that is the indication that there may be an earthquake.
Thank you for your call.
This is one of the things that bothers me about the Japanese one, is that, you know, these earthquakes tend to happen. I mean, basically, what you've got is these massive pieces of rock under the surface of the earth moving against each other. That causes the shaking. If, for whatever reason, that gets jammed, and it's not running, these giant pieces of rock are not running smoothly against each other, they've actually got jammed. That's when an earthquake can happen.
Well,
and
I mean,
the longer that the shaking stops, that's when you've really got to worry. Thankfully, though, the tsunami warnings all worked in Japan. The only problem, of course, was that many people just chose to ignore them.
Well, I mean, it's always the way, isn't it, with the people that if a warning is given out, most of the times warnings will go ignored because of a false alarm. And as Japan is one of the hotbeds of earthquake, well, I mean, it's hardly surprising.
Well, one of the worst things you can imagine, of course, is getting into your car, trying to drive away, and then finding yourself stuck in a traffic jam.
Indeed. Indeed.
Absolutely horrendous. The best thing to do, I would have said, would be to just physically get up to higher ground. You know, forget your car and just, you know, get to the nearest hill.
Now, Tony, I just want to touch on, obviously, I'm conscious of time here as well. In the last couple of years, well, the last two, 3 years ago, there's often the analogy that when we face tough economic situations, wars come about, and often there can be a move from more kind of liberal, you know, thinking to a more far-right kind of thinking. Now, it's interesting to see that in the last 2-3 years or so, a small group that's getting bigger and bigger, calling themselves the English Defence League, are becoming more and more prominent. Their marches are happening all over the place. They're getting in the news. They've got a very interesting dialogue as well. And I believe you had a few words to say on them, didn't you?
Well, that's right. I mean, we had this amazing story last week, which was with a journalist at the Daily Star, Mr. Pepiot. He actually came out and put an article in The Guardian saying that he had been being paid bonuses at the Daily Star to make up anti-Islamic stories. Now, you know, this is really rather worrying to think that a national newspaper, I mean, as the Daily Star is really kind of more of a comic than a newspaper, but actually other newspapers were picking up on these stories, as they often do, and radio stations, etc., were picking up on these news stories. And actually, these anti-Islamic stories were total bunkum. Now, I'm really worried that this is the kind of thing which is actually fueling a complete disinformation campaign, particularly aimed at Muslims. The problem being, of course, that this looks rather similar to the nasty stuff which was being concocted by Adolf Hitler back in the 1930s against the Jews. Now, this kind of incident really, really worries me. But, I mean, having said that, I also think it's important that people who have these obnoxious racist views do have the freedom to express them. Because what happens if you try and deny people freedom of speech is it drives these kind of movements underground. I think, you know, what we've got to have is a mature discussion. And I actually pat the BBC on the back for having Nick Griffin on Question Time last year, actually allowing him to be, criticised.
Yeah, I think it was a good thing,
as well as actually hearing his views.
Yes,
I think in any kind of healthy democracy, you have freedom of speech. This is like number one freedom of speech. It's so important. But that means you have to have the freedom for people to express views that you really do actually despise. You know, that is freedom of speech. You've only got freedom of speech when people can express views that you totally disagree with. And that, you know, for me, certainly is the case with the BNP and the English Defence League.
Interesting thing, Tony. Where do you stand on the whole issue of hate speech, then?
Well, I mean, I think you have to be there has to be a certain amount of responsibility. Just imagine if Nick Griffin had come out with really, you know, sort of really horrendous racist remarks on Question Time. Do you think it would have done him any good?
Well, actually, no. I don't think he's stupid enough to do that, to be honest.
I mean, a lot of this hate speech is actually something which is done, you know, clandestinely and quietly, and it's seen as a sort of, you know, we're not allowed to say this in public. But actually, I think actually creating the atmosphere where that kind of thing goes on is a bad thing in itself. But it is quite interesting because many people say, well, actually, you can express yourself, but you mustn't incite violence. And then what do you hear? You hear David Cameron talking about bombing Libya and bombing their various installations in Libya. Now, hang on a minute. David Cameron is inciting violence there.
Well, so, absolutely.
So please don't lecture the general public on inciting violence.
I mean, it's like saying that they practice what you preach.
Yeah, I mean, Martin is not a pacifist. I actually am a pacifist, although I think everybody has got the right to self-defence, such as the Palestinians, for example. You know, people who are being invaded, and the Afghanis, by the way, people who are being invaded by another foreign force, I think, do have the right to self-defense. But, you know, generally speaking, I think in social movements, we should be having peaceful social movements. And isn't it fascinating to see what's been happening in Bahrain?
But sometimes, you know, Tony, peace isn't the, or, you know, it's not the way to actually resolve a situation. Sometimes military intervention has to be applied to actually resolve an issue. I mean, what is your stance on that?
Well, I think, you know, if you're looking at something like the Second World War, you know, it's very difficult to remain a pacifist in a situation where you have a lunatic, I would say. I mean, the myths of the German Reich were really all to do with their master race and the Teutonic Knights returning and how Germany was destined to rule the world, all these kind of strange myths. you know, it's very difficult to actually see a situation where people would just try and resist that passively. But thankfully, I mean, we don't have that kind of force in the world today, although many people would argue that what the United States is doing through its foreign policy is kind of akin to that, you know, interventionist approach which happened in places like Poland and Czechoslovakia, and then eventually, obviously, France and, you know, and other places too. So, you know, I would say I think the best resistance is through truth and through peaceful means. You know, Martin has a slightly different approach to me, and I think he's... You know, but having said that, I think every country has to have means of... Isn't it interesting the way that the Japanese don't have an army. They have something called what they call a self-defense force. And they're making it absolutely clear there that these are soldiers that are only going to be used in defense of Japanese territory. They're not going to be sent abroad to bomb, kill, and invade other countries, which seems to be the de rigueur for the United States going around the world doing...
And to extend the United Kingdom, Tony.
Well, that's right. And it is. I find it absolutely incredible the difference in the way that our Western leaders are talking about what's going on in Bahrain and what's going on in Libya, because they don't seem to be supporting the Bahraini people when they're calling for just some basic, very, very basic rights, whereas they are supporting the rebels in Libya. It just seems absolutely incredible that they can talk about the two. Why aren't they condemning the Bahrain leaders for bringing in foreign troops from Saudi Arabia to put down peaceful demonstrations in Bahrain? Why aren't they condemning those leaders? There's total double standards.
And that's where we're going to have to leave it, Tony. Just quickly, as I say, time is our only enemy on this show, of course. And so quickly, Tony, tell us what we've got coming up on Mr. Community Radio this week.
Well, we are here in Bristol, in the Bristol Channel. We're one of the most highly populated by nuclear power stations areas of the country. So we're going to be taking a really close look at, you know, what the implications of what's been going on in Japan are for people here in Bristol. I mean, the Hinkley Point Power Station, which is down near Bridgewater, is actually directly upwind of here. So if anything was to happen at Hinkley Power Station, there'd be a radioactive plume would head straight towards Bristol. So, you know, we're going to be looking at nuclear safety, basically, in our surrounding area here. And they're talking about building two new nuclear power stations on our doorstep.
And that's rather worrying, Tony. Well, Tony, as ever, thank you very much again for giving us your time on Behind the Headlines.
Listen, guys, God bless and thanks for having me.
And God bless you too, Tony.
Thank you very much.
That's it then. You heard Tony Gosling. And as I say today, it's been a show, mostly we've been talking about Japan, and it's understandably so after the tragic event that's taken place on Friday. And may things get easier for the people of Japan, and even if we can't be with them physically, we are there with them.
Of course, thoughts and prayers are with them in this difficult
absolutely,
time.
Absolutely. And may Allah protect us all, actually, from this kind of disasters.
Please do join us next week at the same time, 8 till 10 p.m. We're here every week, and with the hottest topics, hopefully every single week. We're on Facebook, Behind the Headlines. And that really is it for us this week, you know. The break's coming up very, very shortly. Thank you for those who listened, those who called, and those who participated, and we hope that you'll be joining us again next week.
Till next week, then, from me and Tariq, it's good evening, and God bless you all. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. And if you've got little ones, give them a hug. Give them a kiss. Tell them you love them.
Ilim 10 9 8 7 6 5 4 3 2 1. It's Ice Smiley Culture with the mic in on me hana. Me come to teach you right hana. Not the wrong in on the Cockney translation. Cockney's not a language, it is only a slang. And was originated, yeah, so in England. The first place it was used was over East London. It was respect for the different style pronunciation. But it wasn't really used by any and any man. This is strictly con man, also the villain. But you may pull up of lyrics and education. Right, you know, you are gonna get a little translation. Cockney have names like Terry Arthur and Del Boy. We have names like Winston, Lloyd and Leroy. We ball out, yo, while Cockney say, oi. What Cockney call a Jacks, we call a Blue Boy. Say Cockney have mates while we have spar. Say Cockney live in a drum while we live in a yard. Say we get nyam while Cockney get captured.
Say company, say governor, we say big boat, yeah. In the company translation, in the company translation. Well, watch a man, the translation of company to understand is easy. So long as you don't deaf and you listen me keenly, you should pick it up like a you to find some money. Go tell it to your friends, also your family. No matter if a English or a yardie, cause you never know when they might buck up a company. Remember one, them and them don't easy. Them no fire slingshot and miss it strictly double B. Them run protection racket and control no CID. Say cut me fire, shoot, ah, we bust gun. Say cut me say tea leaf, we just a sticks man. You know them have wedge while we have con. Say cut me say big first mutton, we just a guan. Say cut me say grass, we say old farmer man. When them talk about iron, them really mean batter man. Rupin and chopper it and miss a company called Tama. Say cut me say outbuilt, we say dirty Babylon. In the company translation, in the company translation. Well watch a man, slam bam, jamana. Hear them fashion, smiley culture, origination. But first let me tell you more about the company who live comfortably and have them yacht by the sea. And when it comes to money, most of them are plenty. But where them spend it? In the bookie, lose it all on the dogs or on the GGs. Or paying off for them bribes to the Sweeney. So them not gonna do no time for no arm robbery or catching anything that fell off the back of a lorry. Slam bama, jamana, hear them a fashiona. Me stronger, me longer, me at the mic sana. More time in a dance, me chat Panatone. But sometimes me shake out and leave me hometown. And that's when me travel at East London. We're after speakers a different man, so that the company can understand. So black man and white man, hear them fashion. Cotton says scare up a wee scatter. Cotton say rabbit, we chatter. We say bleach, cotton in a cod. Cotton say terrific, we say waka. We say blouts, we say guys, come and say all right, we say ice, we say pants, come and say stride, sweet as a nut. Just level vibes, saying.